This podcast is brought to you by The Province.
The Province Sports Podcast. Back in the seats for another podcast at Rogers Arena. Jason Botchford will join me here in a sec. The podcast is always a presentation of Eagle Ridge GM and Coquitlam, proud sponsors of the BCHL Coquitlam Express, and your first overall pick for selection and inventory. I was on their website earlier today. If you're in the market for a vehicle, you should probably start your research there online, eagleridgegm.com. The car buying experience made that much easier. A great website, so check them out online, eagleridgegm.com. And then from there, when you're ready to buy a car, I would suggest you barge through the front doors of the showroom and you say, I listen to the podcast. I don't know what that'll get you, but they're going to take care of you regardless. But if you tell them that Botchford sent you, something tells me you might get yourself an even better deal. So again, we thank Eagle Ridge GM for sponsoring the podcast. Botch, here we are back at the Raj. Henrik Sedin closing in on 1,000 points, a visit from Roberto Luongo. All sorts of stuff going on with this hockey team that can't score goals but can't lose hockey games outright either.
Yeah, I think, how did you phrase it? They're getting it done. And this was my, I brought this up at the beginning of the season. This was always kind of my concern about how the 65-point and the 63-point predictions were going to color the rest of the year and change perceptions. Because now all the talk is Willie, maybe he's gone from being the guy on the hot seat to a guy who's a Jack Adams candidate. Even though they're only two games above 500 here, which I guess is good. I mean, it's good compared to where they were, certainly, and after the nine-game losing streak. But I went back and checked where Vegas had this team. That's pretty a good barometer of how the betting public, how the public in general sees them. Their over-under on points was about 77. So now they're on a pace for about 85.5. Is that incredible? Is that getting it done? I'm not sure, you know. I think that they need a few more wins. A lot of people saw this month and saw it kind of, it broke well for the Canucks, and it was an opportunity for them to make some hay. And credit to them, because they have been making hay. They have been getting things done, and now they have an opportunity for a big night. You know, obviously the emotion is going to be in the arena. I think anytime that Luongo comes back and, you know, Henrik Sedin has his shot at 1,000 points. I actually have Luongo, I think, on my Mount Rushmore of Canucks. I don't know who your four are, but I think I'm putting Luongo up there.
Yeah, I think I probably would find a spot for Luongo. I mean, the easy answer would be the Twins. And then, you know, Trevor Linden would probably have to be on a Mount Rushmore of Vancouver Canucks, but then what do you do with Stan Smeal? And does that diminish what Marcus Naslund did in his years here and Pat Quinn? So that's certainly a topic that we could kick around. Let me say this about the Vancouver Canucks right here, right now. They have one outright loss in the last five games. They've scored 8 goals in those 5 games, and they have one outright loss. I completely realize that wins for this team right now are detrimental to the long-term rebuild. I get that what this team needs is to finish low and draft high. But there is a part of me that's coming around on this group to see just how far, I want to see just how far they can ride this. Because now it's fascinating to me, Botch, that the margins are so slim that overturn goals against New Jersey and Nashville. If New Jersey's goal late in the game stands, the Canucks get nothing out of that game. If Nashville's goal stands, and again, the intent to blow rule, but if that goal stands and Nashville opens the scoring, who knows if the Canucks ever score? Maybe the Canucks get no points out of these last two games, and instead they get 3 of the 4 points available to them. The margins are that thin right now that overturn goals by the war room are keeping the Canucks in this race.
Yeah, that intent to blow, that is the craziest call I've ever seen go in favor of the Canucks. I've seen some wild calls go against them. Daniel Sedin kicked in goal. You know, there's the Aaron Rome suspension decision. But as far as the NHL making a decision in favor of the Canucks, in the history of time that I've been in Vancouver, I've never seen a, like, he literally made that up. Like, that guy, Hebert, had no fucking intention of blowing that play dead. He was on the horn for 5 minutes. Five full minutes. Like, count them out. It was five full minutes that he was talking to the war room in Toronto. You watch that replay. When they have the intent to blow the whistle, they're dramatically waving the goal off. I meant to blow it. It doesn't count. That was the exact opposite. He could not have been more excited to call that puck in the net. Like, that arm went up and down like three or four times. That was a goal. No chance he was going to blow the whistle. Like, the puck crossed the line, drifted into the back of the net. The whistle still wasn't blown. When was he going to blow it? It made no sense. But again, it's a call that goes the Canucks' way. There's been quite a few of them, a lot more than we're normally used to. And yeah, it certainly has helped the Canucks stay in this playoff race. And it does add credence, without a doubt, to the people that say the NHL is trying to get the Canadian teams in the playoffs this year.
Well, and the New Jersey one, you know, you had to wind it back, skate off the ice over the blue line. You know, and again, yeah, and that's late in the third period of a 1-1 tie. But it's been more of these games, and we talk about eight goals in five games, you know, ride it back to the Nashville game on the road. The Philadelphia game is the outlier because there were some goals there. But then they come back home, you know, one goal against Jersey, one goal against Nashville. Like, it is unbelievable. Like, they've returned to sort of the team that we saw in the early going, but that team didn't get results. Right now, again, these guys are somehow finding a way to scratch out results.
And they've got Ryan Miller going. They've buried Jacob Markstrom, who has two starts this month after posting like a 930 save percentage in December. It did not matter. And yeah, Ryan Miller is in a great rhythm right now. And I thought that you were making an interesting point before we started the podcast here, that it's now virtually impossible for this team to trade Ryan Miller. That, A, they're not likely going to be in a position where they're out of the playoff race. Probably not by the time the trade deadline. But even if they were, Ryan Miller's probably not going not wanting to go anywhere. Like, I keep saying Dallas is the landing spot for him, but you don't think that that's possible.
Well, I just think the longer that the Canucks stay in this race, and as long as Dallas is one of those teams, that the Canucks aren't going to trade a guy like Miller to a club like Dallas that then might, you know, use a ride Miller and bump the Canucks. Like, the Canucks have come this far. I think they think that given the parameters in the Western Conference this year, and this just happens to be a year where the West is down, and that allows the Canucks to be in this mix. But, you know, if they're in the mix near the trade deadline, chances are it's on the back of Ryan Miller. The guy's playing. He's playing well. He's playing a ton. I don't think he wants to go anywhere where he's going to be a backup. Like, I don't think that interests him at this stage of his career. You know, you can talk about being a backup, but still getting your chance to win a Stanley Cup. I don't know if that interests Ryan Miller. I think he's in a perfect position here where he's playing a ton. He's getting an opportunity. And if Dallas falls off by the deadline, remember, he's got trade protection. He's got some say in this. If Dallas falls out of the race, then I don't think for a second that Ryan Miller has any interest in going to a team just to play out the string. Why wouldn't he stay here? And it's pretty clear that the head coach values what Ryan Miller's delivering, and that's why he's playing as much as he is.
Like, my logic has been that he has everything, right? He's got all the money in the world, and the one thing that he's lacking is playoff success. Is a Stanley Cup victory. I would think at this point in his career, he would try to chase that. That's why I don't think he's going to be coming back. But if you expand the logic you have now, it really wouldn't change, I wouldn't think, if you like look toward the offseason. So if I'm following what you're kind of spinning right now, I think you're telling me Ryan Miller's coming back next year, maybe on a 2-year deal.
I don't know about a 2-year deal, but I do think that he's been down the road of being traded before. didn't work out for him, didn't work out for St. Louis, and I think maybe that clouds his judgment a little bit. And again, I haven't had a chance to sit down with him and find out, you know, just how badly he burns to win a Stanley Cup. But as I watch these guys more and more on the money that they make, I don't know that winning a Stanley Cup is the driving force that it maybe once was with hockey players. Like, these guys are set up for life. They're comfortable in their situations. They've got the no trade protection. You know, it gives them the hammer here. And we saw that last year with a guy like Dan Hamhuis and obviously Verbata. That's a different story. But, you know, I think that situation, life situations and taking care of your family and not uprooting your family, I think that means more to some of these guys at this stage of their career than absolutely getting their hands on the Stanley Cup. And that's where I wonder, if you're a goaltender and you're being brought in just to be a backup, like, does he want to sit on the bench and just be a cheerleader at this stage? Or wouldn't he rather be in a spot where he's playing and playing well and playing a lot right now?
Yeah, and unfortunately for Jacob Markstrom, the season, like, he's basically, since when they're both healthy, Miller and Markstrom, Markstrom's basically playing once a week. The season is going to end. He's going to be 27 years old, and he's not going to have started, unless an injury happens to Miller here, he's not going to have started more than 35 games. And then you head into the summer, and once again, they have no one has any idea on whether Jacob Markstrom is ready to be a number one guy in the NHL. And what I'm going to ask you is, do you think that that's reflective of how the management and front office view, like, do they believe in Jacob Markstrom? Do they believe in him?
I think you're seeing a head coach that clearly has some questions still. Although he says constantly, we've got two good goaltenders, two guys that I like, but actions speak louder than words, and there's a reason. I mean, Jim Benning came out at the start of the season and pounded his fist on the desk and, you know, emphatically declared, make no mistake, Ryan Miller is our number one, and they have treated him that way. And, you know, here lately, he's responded. Before Christmas, there were some issues, and his numbers reflected that. Since Christmas, he has been the best Vancouver Canuck. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And so, again, the longer they stay in this mix, and that's the word I keep using, but, Botch, when you look at what's going on around all these other flawed teams in the playoff chase too, like, there's no reason to think a month from now that the Vancouver Canucks aren't going to be in a similar position where they'll still be within striking distance. Like, they're not going to, the way they're playing and the way they're gathering points, I don't see them falling out of this race for a while still. I mean, the road is going to issue the huge challenges. And I wrote about this last Sunday that, I mean, the remaining road record or road schedule after the All-Star break is hellacious for a team with five road wins. Like, I think that's ultimately what's going to catch up and do in the Vancouver Canucks is having to go into Chicago and Pittsburgh and Columbus and Minnesota and St. Louis and Anaheim and San Jose. It's a murderer's row for them still as the road team. And so while it's kind of been fun to watch them scratch and claw their way and stay in the playoff picture right now, I do think that the day of reckoning is coming. But even this road trip coming up here, you know, Colorado and Arizona, like, those are, you know, giveable games, points that are there for the taking. So certainly through the All-Star break, they have a chance here to continue to amass points. But as far as the goaltending is concerned, I do think that the organization still has some questions about Markstrom, and that's why you're seeing Ryan Miller play as much as he does.
Yeah, I see that. I think this is a 500 team. I saw that at the bit. This is kind of how I viewed them at the beginning of the year. And if 500 keeps them in a playoff race this year because of a really weak in Western Conference, then they're going to be in a playoff race because they're going to hover around that 500 mark, I think, right basically to the end of the season. Now, the other thing that came up today, what I, you know, talk about the way that the franchise views things, Jim Benning talking about the power play and suggests that the head coach is going to make changes to his personnel. Now, this got a lot of attention recently because in your questioning the other night after the Jersey game, Willie was at it. Like, to me, you got the quote of the year when he said, well, you want me to ride with the 12, you don't think I should ride with the 12% or 12, eh? Like, that was, it's an amazing, I can't even believe that you got it out of him. Now you've taken some hits, some criticism for the question. I love it. Like, I'm a huge fan of your questions. Was it too much, do you think? Like, it worked out perfectly because the end result was great. You got a great quote
And you got this reaction from Willie that I don't think that we've seen basically since he's been here. But you did give him a little body blow at the end when you mentioned that the power play was gunning at 12%. Like, it was a little extra shot you don't normally give. Had you plotted that out? Had you planned to add that jam in there at the end, or did that just come naturally at the moment?
Well, I didn't want him to tell me once again that the power play had been pretty good, because out on the road trip, the Nashville game and the shorthanded goal in overtime on the power play, and then Philadelphia, 8 power plays, and they only cashed in on the 5-on-3. And so the power play was a huge issue out on the road trip, and he was asked about it then, and obviously we weren't on that trip, so didn't have access to him, and he kept spinning that, oh, you know, the first 20 games, power play had been pretty good, and maybe a little bit here and there, but, you know, like, in his eyes, he didn't get to the point that, no, this power play has been costing this hockey club that continues to score just one goal a game, basically, for the last week or so. And so, you know, I didn't want to let him off the hook with an opportunity to tell me that the power play was good. So I had to come armed with some knowledge, some facts. I did my research, and since December 1st, after that Jersey game, the power play was at 12%. Now, the worst power play in the National Hockey League, the Detroit Red Wings this year, is over 12% for the season. So my point was, you know, you're riding a power play right now since December 1st for 6 weeks that's been at 12%. In those 6 weeks, your power play is worse than the 30th power play in the NHL. You can't possibly tell me that that's a good power play. So I didn't go to that length with the question, but I wanted to come armed with a little bit of knowledge. And yeah, clearly he got his backup.
Yeah, I didn't believe Benning at all this morning when I heard him say that Willie was thinking about changing the personnel, because he was adamant in that line of questioning that you and I think Kuz was in there asking questions as well, that he was not going to change things. That it was got back to a point that we've made on here, I think a couple of weeks ago, where Willie made some comment about how he's not ready to experiment. He's not willing to experiment with this power play. And as we are having this conversation, I am watching the power play practice, and there has been no changes to the personnel. They've kind of moved Berchi to the high slot and Sutter to the back door, but the personnel on both units are the same as they ever were.
And you've done some nice work as well in the Provies. One day you totally deconstructed the power play over the last 5 years. And as much as we all love Daniel and Henrik as human beings and hockey players, I mean, they're the common denominator here over these 5 years as the power play has been in decline. And one thing that I love about the age that we live in is you get people now who will give you a screen capture of the way the Canucks set up, in this case, on the power play. And I saw one, I think it was as recently as the New Jersey game, where Henrik is in his spot on the right side boards, holding onto the puck, and teams just, they know now. He's so not a threat to shoot. And you had the graph, the heat graph as well, that you've used. And again, I love the information that's available to us. For me, it's not so much about personnel. It's that the entire NHL knows that as Henrik Sedin sits on the sideboards, he is zero threat to shoot the puck. Like, he's just, that's not in him, and it's never really been who he is. But you get these screen captures now, and you see how much room teams give him, because the forward out high, he cheats to Troy Stetcher. The defense down low, they just collapse around their guys in front of the net. And if Henrik would attack the net, even on occasion, take a few strides in from the sideboards, we saw him score a goal at Madison Square this year. Remember, he stepped out of the penalty box and got into the rush and blew a puck pass. Was it Ranta, I think, was still in goal then. But I'm not saying Henrik has to shoot all the time. But if he was a threat to shoot, it would force the defense, the other team's penalty killers, to adjust, react. And then it would free up some of his passing options. But right now, he is so static. And it's either down to Daniel down low or out to Stetcher at the point. But again, if you see these still frames, you see how much space he could walk into the faceoff dot and, you know, on occasion let a shot go, but see what happens. See how the defense reacts at that point and then adjust accordingly. So to me, it's tactical probably more so than it is personnel.
Well, and one of the big theories out there is split the Sedins, put them on different power plays. And I think that that's got merit to at least try, because if you go back the past 5 years, they've been brutal. This has been the 29th ranked power play in the NHL. So nearly last over the course of five freaking years through three different coaching staffs with one constant, the Sedins both on the power play and Henrik on the half wall. And as you lay that out, the amount of space, other, what that does, it, the rest of the ice is a 4-on-4. You lose your man advantage. I say, why not flip Henrik and like, why can't Henrik play around the net in front of the net and do what Daniel does? That's not requiring him to take a big wrist shot or a big slap shot. It's requiring him to pick up a rebound and dump it in the net. And then Daniel can play the half boards, and he is a threat to take a shot. He still does. And you would like him to shoot more, but he still does have a pretty good shot. I don't think, like, the fact that Daniel is only taking 11% of the shots on net on that power play is unbelievable to me, because he's supposed to have one of the best shots on the team. They're never utilizing that. But again, the head coach won't try. They won't even do a subtle thing. Like, their big move here is to move Sutter, who was playing in front of the net, behind the net. Now he's back in that typical Ryan Kessler trigger man role, and that's the big change that Willie is comfortable making. I don't think he's willing to make many more changes than that.
I went back and I looked at it. Daniel's got five power play goals. Two of them on 5-on-3s have both been shots from the high slot. In Philadelphia, it was a snapshot, and he picked his spot. In Jersey, it was more of a slap shot.
But he had a lot of movement on that Jersey one. There was a ton of movement in that 5-on-3. Guys moved around. He ended up on that point on the left side from moving in front of the net to up top, and he got a free moment. He had lots of time, and he nailed the shot.
But those are 5-on-3s, and so you're not getting a ton of those. But my point is that I went and looked at all five of his power play goals. Four of them have been shots from relative distance, and one was in Florida, was a deflection in the high slot. Like, Daniel scores none of his power play goals in tight. He doesn't score on deflections in front of the net. He doesn't score on rebounds. He's not a second chance opportunity guy. And so to me, yeah, he's totally miscast there. You know, Sutter's scored in a handful of different ways, a couple of them off the rush. I'm not sure that you can write the book on Brandon Sutter and his power play contributions. But again, so much of it just seems misguided. But if, you know, you and I sit here in row 15 today and we can see it, these guys do tape. They review this stuff. They analyze it. They've got all sorts of layers in the organization. Like, somebody has to see this, don't they?
Can you, like, this is what I was thinking about on the way in today. Can you imagine if all of this was happening, all the attention on the power play? Like, there have been days where the entire all of the hockey fans have been engrossed in this power play. Everyone's got an opinion, at least all of the ones that are still interested in this team. Can you imagine if through all of this, Yannick Hansen was healthy and playing and scoring goals and not on the power play? Like, the number of melts that would have been happening over the course of the past 3 weeks, month.
I like a good firestorm, you know that. And that would be next level.
Like the coach would be asked about it almost every time the power play came up, especially after a loss. Why isn't Yannick Hansen on the power play? DT would be explaining, like, defending, like, why, the reasons why you can't put Hansen there. I would be writing about it forever. You would be talking. Like, it would be wild if Yannick Hansen were to be healthy through this.
Then the topper on all that would finally be to see Willie relent and put Hansen on the power play and have him score. And have, after all this, have Yannick Hansen come back and contribute.
Except it would be two games. He wouldn't score. And everyone would be like, see, it doesn't work. And that was kind of like the attitude when we were saying, like, get Megna off the Sedin line. Get Sutter off the Sedin line. Put Eriksson there. And you, we talked about it, I think, last week, where his first or second game, he didn't get a shot on net. Progressively, guess what? The Sedins and Eriksson are figuring it out. They look better and better and better. The Sedins almost at times look like the Sedins again. And all of a sudden, they're having games. You know, they're pretty good the past couple of games where they had, like, long shifts where they generated pressure and they generated, you know, Henrik ends up scoring on an attempted pass. But I think that the goal was reflective of how those guys are playing. And all of a sudden, Eriksson's foot speed doesn't appear to be a problem right now.
PatCast is a presentation of Eagle Ridge GM out in Coquitlam on the Barnett Highway. Open weekdays and weekends. Their schedule will suit your schedule. Check them out online, eagleridgegm.com. So that begs the question, because Jim Benning said this morning, Hansen back after the All-Star break. There's a home game and then three out on the road. So four more games. And then Yannick Hansen, who had that knee banged up just before Christmas, that fits the timeline. Then what do you do with your man Yannick Hansen when he comes back? Do you plug him in with the Twins? Or if this Erickson and the Sedins, I don't want to call it an experiment, but a return to Erickson with the Twins, if that's still working, does Hansen then go with Granlund and Sutter?
Yeah, I tend to think that Willie's going to stay with Hansen with the Twins. Like, that seems to be his, like, he's got it in his head that the Sedins have to have speed on their line. And that was his whole kind of theory or basis of why he was putting Megna there. So I think his inclination is going to be to put Hansen there. But if it is going, if Erickson and the Sedins are going by then and they are producing, you got to leave them together. And in fact, not only that, I would be thinking about putting Erickson on the first power play unit, letting him, like, why can't he play net front on that unit? Like, it's crazy to me, but I think Hansen's going to make it work wherever he is. I would probably end up, if that line is going at all, keep Erickson there, put Hansen with Sutter.
So you don't think they should ride it at 12%, eh?
Man, like, what was he saying? Like, did he mean like 12 is good? What was that comment? What did you infer from that? Like, what was he inferring here?
That he understands that the power play isn't good enough. And so he was just trying to get a bit of a dig back in, right? That, look, smart guy, like, I get it, 12% isn't where it needs to be. But then it was strange, because then he went on sort of this ramble that got into, we've got three defensemen out of the lineup, you know, none of whom really play the power play. So it wasn't power play related. And it was almost like, why are you questioning me? I'm great. I'm getting everything. I'm squeezing everything I can out of this team. And I mean, on a certain level, you do have to say, like, this is a group that really has no business being in the playoff picture, but we've established that this year, the playoff picture, the parameters are a little bit different. It is strange in that regard. But, I mean, how much longer they can stay there? Again, one goal in four of their last five games. They scored once. And so that's why the power play is such a huge issue, because the power play's had a chance to be a difference maker. It hasn't come through. But stubborn Willie is going to stay with the guys that he's got here. You talk about quotes of the year. How about his effusive praise for Reed Boucher for coming off the ice after a 5-second shift? Like, that was bizarre the other night.
That was one of the happiest moments that I've seen Willie describing any player at any time. And it is crazy. Like, he was so effusive on Reed Boucher. I thought he was going to talk about some amazing play he had that I missed, some great back check that I missed. But what he gave credit Boucher for was that Erickson kept, like, I mean, Erickson was wild that game. He kept taking, like, he would not leave the ice. Like, the Sedins would leave and he'd be like, no, screw it, I'm staying on. And he had, like, these crazy long, like, minute plus shifts. Like, one of his shifts was like a minute 50. He was not leaving. Like, he was just bent on staying out there. So one of them, he ended up staying out there for a minute 24. So he took up his whole shift and most of the fourth line shift. And he finally decides to come out. And what Willie loved is that Boucher went on the ice with the fourth line. And then when they were done, he didn't pull an Erickson. He came up right off the ice and he really loved it, man. He just loved it. It's very rare that he gives that much credit to a player, especially a guy who just a week ago, he dressed a totally injured Anton Rodin, made him sit on the bench for an entire game inexplicably, a game after. Think about what happened. His shin pad rolled off his leg. His knee made skin on ice contact, basically, with the ice, bruised and swollen. And he put him on the bench because he did not trust Reed Boucher. Now, because of a 5-second, it was actually 11-second, because of an 11-second shift, he totally trusts Reed Boucher.
But I'm so with you, because I was in there in Willie's post game, and I thought with his answer, you know, he said, oh, he was good or really good or whatever he said. And when he kind of, he prefaced it that way. And I thought, okay, what did I miss? Like I watched every shift and he had a hit early on, but like, what did I miss? What did the coach see here? Yeah. It wasn't anything to do with the game. It wasn't even like, he didn't get into details about, you know, his reaction on the bench when he was told that his 11-second shift, like, what were Boucher's options? It was a stoppage in play. Like, he couldn't stay out there and protest and tell the coach, no, screw it, I'm not coming off. Deal with it. Like, it was so bizarre. So, okay, I'm glad that it wasn't just me that read all of that. It was strange, to say the very least. Hey, you and I have been ahead of the curve on the Tramkin train here. You know that he's a huge central theme to what we do on the podcast. I think people are starting to pick up on it. But
it honestly was not that long ago, let's remember, where the Canucks came to you and said, the only two people in town talking about Tramkin are you and me. So I don't think that's the case any longer.
No, it's not. And with good reason. He wasn't very good in Philadelphia. And then I don't know if he looked himself in the mirror or if somebody sat him down. I kind of thought maybe he hit at a wall and they might actually, they had Pedan here. I thought for a second, you know, they lose 5-4. They give up a bunch of goals. I thought maybe they were looking at making a change. But the Jersey game, he had the breakout that he started with the knee where he kicked the puck ahead and chased after it. He was jumping up into the rush. He's taking it upon himself to get to the front of the net at times. And then the other night here against Nashville, was all over the ice, plays the 20-plus, the big hits. His sort of cult status grew by leaps and bounds in this 1 week alone. I ask you, because there's been a lot of talk about Eric Gudbranson and what they're going to do with him and his contract situation at the end of the season. Horvat obviously is getting a new deal too, but Tramkin needs a contract. He's a restricted free agent at the end of the season. We know the leverage that he had coming over in his first contract. Of those three guys, whose contract is the most intriguing to you and the way it's going to be handled by the organization?
Well, I think the most intriguing, without a doubt, is Gudbranson, because it has the potential to be massive. This is a guy that was seeking $5 million plus from the Florida Panthers. You wonder, you know, I have to think that the injury just really changes everything, because how can you like, what we saw this year was not good. It just wasn't. He arguably has been their worst regular defenseman this season. I don't know how much of that was his hand. He tore multiple ligaments in his hand, and he says for most of the season he played with it. I tried to kind of pin him down on certain dates, but I couldn't. Basically, by the end of November, he said he knew he needed surgery. It was just a matter of when. He continued to play and ended up, you know, seeking outside medical opinions and came back to the Canucks and said, look, I, you know, and they all came together, I guess, at some point and said the surgery's got to happen. Now, I don't know what Gudbranson, so I'm most intrigued by what's going to happen there, because I think that anything over $4.5 million a year is going to be a huge anchor, a huge weight for this franchise. I'm a little bit intrigued by Tramkin, sure, but he's not going to have any points. So he's not going to get a big, massive, like, you know, maybe doubles his salary to 1.8 or something like that, but he's just never going to be in a position to collect points, to be on the power play. And so I think that they have an easier time dealing with Tramkin. Will he have a clause in the new contract that says he cannot go back to Utica? Like, will that continue? Like, could you give him that again? The funny thing, though, is if Gudbranson was healthy, Tramkin isn't playing, and Trampkin's and he admitted to us that he's thinking about, if that all of those scenarios chips happen, Willie admitted if Gudbranson was healthy, Tramkin wouldn't be playing. And then Tramkin said, if I wasn't playing, I'd be thinking about going back to Russia. So it's crazy how it all worked out. But I agree, like, he's getting better. And I thought, like, sometimes when I talk to Lucas Pisa, it seems like what he's saying is spot on. It's on target, makes a lot of sense. And then I go back to listen to the audio and I'm thinking, oh, wait a minute. Like, is he even answering my question here? But he did make some salient points about Tramkin in that game that he had against Nashville. And he said, like, it takes a long time for a guy to figure out where to play on the ice and not make mistakes. So he's not getting run and not getting, like, pyloned, not getting worked. And I think that, and as he said, over time, as Trampkin's got the confidence of where to be on the ice, then he figures out where I can launch into taking hits and where I can take the opportunity to be more aggressive physically. What got me about all of those hits, he put very little Like, there was very little effort into any of them. Like, he knocked Johansson down like a sack of potatoes, and he barely moved. It was just kind of, he shrugged, and he knocked him right down. There's play along the boards where he barely did anything, and he turned that guy like a tea kettle, ass over head, along the boards. So I think at the end of the year, though, you're going to be looking at champions being playing 18 minutes a game probably. But still, they're going to say, like, look, the only reason he was playing was because we had injuries.
But he's certainly here. Like, it's hard to imagine now when you think of the way his season started with his conditioning and the fact that he couldn't get into the lineup. And now, I mean, people are buying tickets. Like, he's putting people in the seats. People are talking about him. They're coming to see Nikita Trampkin do his thing. And he is a big...
I want to see Trampkin jerseys. But I will ask you this. If Gudbranson was healthy tomorrow, he's playing. Who's coming out?
Well, Biega would be the obvious choice to come out. But it also begs the question, and we're going to finish up here...
If Gudbranson and Hutton are healthy, who's coming out? Biega won. Who's next?
Is it Stetcher?
Or is it Spezza, who's now reached his expansion threshold, so they've at least covered that part off? There are decisions. There's no question. But I'm with you that Eric Gudbranson, who, by all accounts, did a nice job in the hometown hockey. I mean, you know, he found his role while he's injured. He looked good on TV. He was doing his thing for the organization there.
He's an amazing spokesman. Like, he looks terrific. He talks terrific. We just don't know if he's an amazing defenseman.
And we're let's finish up with defenseman, because news of the day is that Jordan Subban has been recalled. If the six they've got right now stay healthy, I can't imagine that Willie DeJardin is willing to alter his lineup and give Subban an opportunity, and yet we spent 5 minutes or more talking about the power play, and maybe that's an area that he could inject a little bit of life, but Stetcher is still the guy, although we've seen Adler getting back into his role on that top power play. You see any way that Jordan Subban plays unless there's an injury?
I don't. I think he should. I think he definitely deserves an opportunity. I think I think he may be their best power play defenseman and the best possibly in the organization. And I think he deserves a shot to go out there and see what he can do in an NHL game. They were looking to get Rodin into the lineup. Like, one of the craziest things about the Rodin story is that they finally put him on the shelf, but only after he was examined because they wanted to play him in that Nashville game. So they said, we're going to play you, Rodin. Now let's check out that knee. How is it? It's pretty bad. Okay, you're not playing again for basically the rest of the season, and you're going to go have an MRI. Like, that's kind of how it worked out for him. But if you're looking to get Rodin in the lineup to see what he can do, damn freaking straight, you should be looking to get Jordan Subban into that lineup to see what he can do.
Well, and also, that was part of what happened on Sunday with the 12% thing, and then I followed up about Reed Boucher, is he any closer, and Willie said no changes. Coming out of the New Jersey game, said, no changes. I'm going to ride. He's going to ride his power play, but he liked his fourth line. So there were no changes.
He said the only way Rodin is getting in the lineup, he specifically said this to you that night. The only way Rodin is getting in the lineup, I'm not playing him on the fourth line. I will put him in if there's an injury to the top nine.
Right. And so then 2 days later, we find out, well, I was going to play him, but now he's injured and he's going to need some rest here. And
Where did that come from? How did that change happen?
Well, it's pretty clear that management, because Jim Benning was on the radio the previous week where he said that they had had discussions about getting Rodin in there, and Jim sounded on the radio like a guy that wanted to play Rodin. Willie certainly has been hesitant, and ultimately, when he's filling out his lineup card, he hadn't been playing Anton Rodin, and again, it depended which day of the week it was, in terms of where his health was, at least for public consumption. Like, I said to you the other night, as I made my way past you in the press box, I said, like, the Rodin thing, like, I need a nap after I digest this Rodin thing on a daily basis, and it exhausts me, Botch. Like, and every day there's a new layer, and I know today Kuz had talked to Rick Celebrini about, you know, this guy's got a birth defect and a two-piece knee. I've learned more about kneecaps, to tell you, in the last 48 hours reading about Anton Rodin, but it's just, honestly, like, the last week or so, I throw my hands in the air, like, I'm done. I'm exhausted by the Anton Rodin story.
I don't think the coach should be in a position where he's saying, like, management wants me to play a player. But Willie did say that, and he admitted to that. And I'm not sure, like, you know, Willie's taking a lot of heat for not putting him in. And like, I can't figure out who to blame. But if management is putting pressure on the coach to play an injured player, Like, doesn't this reflect poorly on management here? Because they knew, like, as we found out, that the Celebrini's making all of, you know, he's doing all this media now, this story, in-house story at Canucks.com, story with Kuz, where basically Brodin has this birth defect with his knee and it's causing inflammation. They've known that, you know, Celebrini said, we've known that since he got here in the summer. So why is management pressuring the coach to put him in the lineup?
I said yesterday, if it gets to the point he needs surgery, you and I need to be in the operating room doing the podcast live, like over, you know, like that would take the podcast to another level. If we could be actually in the operating theater, recording something as Anton Rodin is having that knee looked at. And again, I mean, that knee has been looked at so many different ways, so many different times. It's amazing that it's taken as long as it has. And I'm with you too. I've played enough hockey to hear the story of the shin pad shifting completely to expose his kneecap. I don't know. How is that possible?
How, that is the worst luck I've ever heard of, or that is a totally, that's a story that didn't happen. I can't decide.
Yeah, in a market like this one with people that have played enough hockey, I think that one is tough to digest, that a knee, I mean, yes, it can move a little bit to expose the kneecap completely so you fall directly on it. I don't know. Again, I didn't see the incident in question. I'll take him at his word, but I do have some reservations there. All right, end of the line for the podcast here. We'll do it again next week as it leads into the All-Star break, and I'm sure there will be new issues to delve into, and we'll do that as we do each and every week here on the podcast on Province Radio, a presentation of Eagle Ridge GM and Coquitlam, proud sponsors of community hockey. Eagle Ridge GM, your one-stop car and truck center, where everyone's a part of their hockey family. They're blowing out 2016s. It's that time of the year in January, so if you're looking for a new vehicle, please start your search with Eagle Ridge GM, at least online, eagleridgegm.com. If you want to see them in the showroom, two blocks west of Coquitlam Center, 2595 Barnett Highway. Again, the website is eagleridgegm.com. Jason Botford, this is Jeff Patterson. Thanks so much for checking us out here on the podcast on Province Radio.